Have you ever wondered what happened to legendary Chuck Norris? He's in his 80s and still is kicking butt and working out and staying active. What's even more shocking is he's stronger, can work out longer, and even has plenty of energy left over for his grandkids. He did this by just making one change. He says he still feels like he's in his 50s. His wife even started doing this one thing too, and she's never felt better. She says she feels 10 years younger, her body looks leaner, and she has energy all day. Chuck's made a 20-minute video explaining step by step how anyone can do the same thing to see incredible changes in their health. Go to mymorningkick.com/SOG and watch Chuck's video right now. Again, that's mymorningkick.com/SOG.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to SOGcast number 5. My name is John Stryker Meyer. I'll be your host tonight, and joining me will be my mystery technician, Tom. Thank you for joining us. On the night of August the 23rd, 1968, in the morning, more than 100 sappers hit FOB-4, a Green Beret top secret operational base in Da Nang, and it was just north of Marble Mountain. During that attack, it came after midnight. It was a moonless night, and the sappers, who were highly trained NBA soldiers, hit the base. And up on the mountain, there had been a recon team up there, Spike Team Rattler. And we'll take it from here from the book On the Ground. Up on the north face of Marble Mountain, ST Rattler was providing security for FOB-4 by acting as an early warning element. But they too were caught unaware by the surprise attack. Assistant team leader Larry Trimble monitored the desperate, disjointed, and chaotic chatter that was coming over his radio. ST Rattler was suddenly attacked by a group of sappers who had made their way undetected to the entrance of the team's observation point, attainable only by climbing ropes hung on the steep mountainside. Before Trimble could think about how they had done it, grenades began detonating all around the ST's small perimeter. Several team members were hit by shrapnel, but the veteran recon men immediately responded with a savage fusillage of Car 15 fire and grenades of their own, dropping them down on the approaching NVA, the North Vietnamese Army, and stopping the assault cold. The observation point overlooked the entire Da Nang compound to the north. By the light of the flares now dropping from the sky, Spike Team Rattler could see human beings scurrying about like cockroaches. The Americans and their Chinese team members watched in disbelief and frustration as the well-orchestrated attack developed. Wave after unrelenting wave of NVA sappers swept in through the east and the side of the compound that faced the South China Sea. As they flooded the compound, buildings exploded in their wake. Dead bodies were left lying dark, stains in the clean white sand. It was clear the enemy had achieved total surprise. ST Rattler was powerless to stop it, and Trimble couldn't see how anyone could survive. Well, joining me today is Larry Trimble. Larry, thank you for coming aboard and making the trip to join us for SOGcast number 5. How you doing?
Real fine. And thank you, John. It's
you
a pleasure
bet.
To be here today.
Thank you. And, you know, it just seems, even though that night was 53 years ago, is still burning fresh in your memory, is it not?
It is.
So if you don't mind, I'd like to read just a couple more paragraphs from the book about that night on your team, how that team provided a crucial element that even though that night we lost 16 Green Berets, the most ever in Green Beret Special Forces history, the body count would have been more severe had your team not been up there. And I wanted to cover the reasons why in the book. Sappers were unquestionably the elite troops of the NBA. Sappers received 6 months of concentrated and highly specialized instruction in assault tactics that involved the use of stealth and demolitions. Their focus was on barrier and defense penetration. They were fanatically dedicated troops, and now a large number of them were inside the wire. The enemy launched attack. Meanwhile, up on the mountain, the enemy launched an intense barrage of 82-millimeter mortar fire at FOB 4 from somewhere behind ST Rattler. As soon as the situation permitted, Trimble made his way towards the south side of the mountain with several of his Nung teammates. The Nung, who had an uncanny ability to ferret out an enemy's location, even in the darkness, pointed silently to the place where the mortar and its crew were hidden. On Trimble's command, he and one of the Nungs fired a volley of HE, high explosive M79 grenades, at the target, while the others poured CAR 15 rounds into the brush. In short order, both the attack on ST Rattler and the mortar fire came to an abrupt and permanent halt. Silencing this well-positioned mortar saved a number of lives and relieved some pressure on those in the Da Nang compound who were fighting hand-to-hand in a frenzied effort to keep from being totally annihilated. So, Larry, you were there. And that night, even 53 years later, I remember how critical that team role was. And so beforehand, was there ordinarily placing recon teams up there as a security measure just in general? Or what was the SOP on that beforehand?
Beforehand, we had had teams up there, but they eliminated them. Figured we had enough security, I think, in the compound. We got alerted on, I think it was about the 21st on a Wednesday, that Team Rattler would move up to that location. And we packed up everything. We did take go up to a briefing myself and it went zero at Ed Ames. And they told us that they had heard possibly that there'd be snipers in that location. And that would be probably the only thing we had to worry about, but they wanted to be ahead of the game. We did move forward. We packed up most of our gear. We had an M16 machine gun. We also had a couple of M79s. We carried as much ammo as we could and water. We did have a 3/4-ton truck, the old beat-up one, but we used that to help us carry the most of the ammo and the stuff up to...
Over the base of Marble Mountain.
Right.
But that 3/4 wasn't going up the mountain.
it wasn't going up. So we had to carry the water and the ammo up. So you can imagine it was rock steps going up a long way. And, of course, we worried about possibly booby traps, also snipers, because of being alerted of that. Going up, it was kind of like a saddle, Marble Mountain was. We went up off of Route 1, the steps started up, and right before you got up there off to the left, we noticed a big opening. It was a cave going back in. We moved up to where it kind of leveled off.
Right.
And off to the left, there was just a small clearing, and at that point is where there had been ropes and previously, you know, placed to get on up to the peak where we was going. I would say, if I remember right, around 30 meters, didn't pay much attention to it then, you know.
Yeah, sure.
We decided to cache our water down there because of going up there. And
the weight.
And the weight.
Yeah.
So we got that taken care of, and then we did go get up there. And set up ourselves, made our perimeter around that location. I would say it was possibly maybe 20 meters in a diameter,
sure.
A flat surface on the top. A lot of rocks. There couldn't have been a chopper come up there and actually land because of the rocks and stuff. Because
when the kinkers would come up, they would set down one wheel, but they couldn't land completely.
Right.
Or if it was a slick, it would put one skid down, but there wasn't enough room for two skids or two wheels.
Exactly.
That's how small your little security area was.
Right, it was.
Oh, yeah.
We started relaxed, but it was eerie. Yeah, you could just, I remember just feeling an eerie feeling, not knowing what that really meant at the time. So I took three of the Nungs myself, and we did it was the next day we did that recon.
Yeah, on August 22nd, you went back and did some recon before all the action started.
Yeah. Actually, we went into the Buddha caves. They have big Buddhas in there, and they had monks in there, but it was quiet. Even the monks were just sitting around, but they wouldn't make no noise.
Yeah, and so those were monks were told they were religious, they would be neutral, but we suspected that they weren't, or at least they were more sympathetic towards the NVA and the Viet Cong that were in the area.
That's true. We did go through both of the caves, or just in, looked around, didn't see nothing, couldn't hear nothing. It was quiet. And then where it leveled off there in the middle of the area where we climbed the ropes, there was an off real small opening, and we went in there, and even as small as I was, we had to crawl up in and get to the top of where that ledge was. We did I could say it couldn't have been, as far as I'm concerned, a better reconnaissance of the area.
Sure.
For any speck in the enemy or anything, and didn't see any, didn't hear nothing.
And just because by you doing that, you probably did more than a lot of other teams did. Because I know some teams would go up, they'd get dropped off by helicopter, or they would go straight up. But you guys were doing it, and this is out of just from your experience, knowing this area, we had reports always about Viet Cong, NV activity. But on the other hand, like your briefing, there's no mention of a major pending attack. You heard nothing about that, as did majority of people in camp, with the exception of two people that we'll talk about a little later.
I had heard that also later on, John, and there was none. We never suspected anything like that. We had security in the compound. They had Cape briefing it up, you know, down at CCN. But it was just unbelievable. You don't think of things like that going to happen with the security we had and stuff. I wasn't even surprised. Once we got up at there and got settled in, then I did have the radio set, you know, with the coordinates over to the Marine outpost.
Right, and they were on the other side.
They were on the other side. They had a 106 recorder's rifle up there. We made contact with them, of course, made contact.
Sure.
The first thing you did when we got up and got set up was make contact with our compounds.
And that way you could avoid friendly fire.
Right. And
particularly with the Marines, because sometimes we had recon teams that had literally contact with the Marines.
Right, that's true. And we got set up, and it was a quiet night even. We kept alert. One thing I did do, though, after that reconnaissance, I was, I think Ames took kind of the first watch.
Uh-huh.
They were supposed to stay awake, but did they, the Nungs? You know, I don't know if they did, but I felt secure enough that with the smallest area we was in.
Sure.
We had them lined out. If anything was to happen, they would wake up pretty fast.
Sure.
I took over somewhere around midnight. And John, as I remember, it was around 2 o'clock, and I can't pinpoint the exact time. There was a...
Because you weren't watching your clock, and it's just another night on the mountain.
Right.
And it's quiet. And actually, aside from winds and chills up there, it's a beautiful view of the China Sea. Look north to Da Nang, you see the city lights, and you go,
yeah.
if you get careless for a minute or two, you just you can think about it as a beautiful scenic sight, forgetting you're right. in a damn war zone right. with Viet Cong and NVA underneath you, and then additionally not realizing that they were prepping for that massive sapper attack on FOB 4.
Right, exactly.
So at some point, your world exploded. So take it for near from those first couple of moments of what you're watching it, seeing it down at the camp and going WTF.
Like you said, it's, you know, it's so beautiful. It was actually beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
Because you could see all the lights, Da Nang, out in the ocean, small boats and stuff like that. Even at that late at night, you know, it's just, it was real beautiful up there. When the first explosion, I switched around real fast seen the explosion over there. First thing I did was switch frequencies. I had it set down on our compound at Talk.
Right.
I switched the frequency over to the Marine outpost over there. I had no answer. And I switched back to tell our people, I switched the frequency back. And just as I was calling Talk down there, or right close to that time, it was when all hell broke loose down there in our compound. It was a shock, you know, at first.
And then the Marines, that outpost got hit also about the same time you got hit, right?
They did. It wasn't but a few seconds after. It was timed well.
Oh, yeah.
They hit us. The point we was made it real good. They. As you had said earlier, they did use hand grenades mostly because, you know, rifle hell, they'd just shoot straight up over us.
Sure.
So we had the advantage up there, but they wanted that point, and I think they wanted it badly. At the time, I did not believe that, or it never entered my mind how important that their location was.
You're a little bit stunned at what's going on down the hill.
Oh, God, yeah.
Seeing the base get hit, and you've been down there 2 days earlier, sleeping comfortably in the hooch at night, right. going to the club, air-conditioned,
right.
drinks.
Yeah, that's true.
Life at a base camp, which is, you know, you don't worry. You're always told to be on guard to a certain
right.
point.
Yeah.
But my gosh, to see that, and you're up there, and then before you know it, you're under attack.
Right. They hit us pretty hard right there. I guess they figured kind of might be an easy target to take over that point because they could look right straight down into the compound.
Right.
And at that advantage point, they could really put some heavy fire in there. As they were hitting us, I saw they would. That's when one of the Nungs called me over. In fact, he was our grenadier, the one with the M79.
Right.
We did have two of them up there, luckily.
Yeah, yeah.
And
did you have your sawed off with you?
No, I didn't. My getaway gun,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Another story I'll tell you about sometime.
All right.
In fact, can I slip it in?
Please, that's why we're here.
We used to make that, you know, cut off the barrel of an M79
sure.
and go up for the vehicle or the maintenance building and get a old muffler clamp, what we called it.
Right.
And then saw off the back of the, where it was like a pistol.
Right.
Well, you know, on the M79, you got the canister rounds, you got a HE round, you got flush hats and stuff.
CS.
And CS. Well, I got my MABE when I got there, you know, because most guys did just put a snap link, you know, onto the front,
right.
and it was a good getaway gun.
Sure.
Well, I went down to test it out, you know, at the beach there along the China Beach, and so I reached out there, and I, pow! Had a can, not a canister round, because you could shoot it with the, you know, the flush hats are the, it wasn't like an HE anyway, and I have blood just split now, you know.
Well, the only thing worse than that is like in my time, when we cut ours down, the first time we experimented, I fired and got hit with my own shrapnel from the M79 round. My first self-inflicted wound.
I think we learned the hard way, didn't we? But we learned.
Yeah. But at least the M79 bounced off your head and you continued to march.
Right.
And so get back to that night. You're on
right.
the mound. The two grenadiers open up and...
Yeah. You could see the flash, you know, right away. The Nugget hollered for me to come over. He's saying, Tonksy, you know, I'm pointing down.
Yeah.
And I seen a flash. And I grabbed up that and I says, fire on him, fire on him. I just started hollering, fire on him, fire
sure.
on him.
And that's where the mortar pit was.
Where we seen a flash. We just literally.
Sure.
As many HE rounds as we could put down there. And also, M16 rounds. You know, I had the whole team just pull over there and start shooting.
And by that time, do you know how many mortar rounds may have been fired?
No.
There was enough that you knew where they were.
Because you're
defending yourself, and then you hear the mortar going off. Okay,
right.
We understand your mental priority. Survive right. First.
Survive
yeah.
First.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
I,
okay.
I didn't know.
We got that.
I did find out later, though, that they had received what they figured was HE rounds falling in there.
Oh, yeah, there's no question about that. Sure.
And he said they were silenced. I didn't know that at the time. All I was looking for, let's get that crap, because you could hear, you could actually hear the 82 rounds
right.
Going over, you know, so you knew it was going into the camp.
So after you secure your perimeter, then you move out to that point, or did you have anything else in between?
It was in between, because actually we was hit one more time that night, or that morning. Two times they tried to take that position. The second time was not near as heavy. I think they decided they better get their act together before they do, because we was littering them with hand grenades, you know.
Right, sure.
So the next morning, of course, hiding our water down at the base didn't work very well. It was hot as hell even at nighttime. I mean, we were literally, everybody was out of water.
Yeah.
You know. And so I took three of the Nungs. And I had to think about how many did I have with me. It was three of the Nungs, myself. Decided to get all the water cans and time to us and go down and fill them up with the five-gallon can of water
right.
We had down at the end of the rope anyway, at that area, which I think I was saying around 20, 30 yards, you know.
Right,
up.
Sure.
The interpreter being, I remember his name of the Nungs.
Oh, yeah.
He went down first. And then the other two guys went down, was going down, and I was the last one that started down the rope. And I heard a bunch of Vietnamese, you know, hollering stuff going on. And I was hollered at Ping, what's going on? What's going on? And he said, VC, VC, they want to surrender. They want to surrender. I said, why the hell ain't you shooting? God damn it. So,
no
so
true boy here.
I kind of just let go of the rope. And it wasn't. You know,
A
few feet. And when we went down, actually, I left my low bearing equipment up there, and they did too. We had all of the canteen strapped around us, and then also filled our pockets full of magazines,
right.
You know, M16 magazines, 20 rounders, what we had then. Started firing them. I think it shocked them. It was just a few of them. I don't know how many. I just figured it was a reconnaissance. A
right.
Bunch of guys going through. But I says, let's get them. So we went after them.
Yeah.
Not thinking nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
And we got right around to where the saddle started to go down towards the amphibious marine outfit.
Right.
And they were going down that. I hollered up to Ames and hollered for him to throw my load bearing equipment, drop it down. You know, it wasn't that far. And he dropped it down, and we started to go ahead. I hollered at Ames. I says, get the M60, you know, and try to shoot in front of us. And so we took off, and we know we actually there was that trail, and we had reconnaissance
the day before.
So
yeah, yeah.
Kind of knew the area, and about where that mortar was firing. We run up, was chasing them guys, and we didn't actually see him. That's why we wanted that fire.
Sure.
But we got about at that location, and there's another damn 82 mortar sitting there, still with the base plate, just camouflaged a little bit. There was a rucksack there, so they kind of had left that stuff, and I guess just went in. Well, I says, grab that tube. We got the rucksack.
Right.
And I says, let's get the hell out of here. Well, let's hightail it back. They're going to get the rack together pretty quick down.
Yeah.
So we ran back, and I was hollering at Ames at the same time. We could holler at each other by voice from where his location
right.
was. It was actually that close.
The last point of your hike to get to the very top.
Yes, sir. And I hollered that we had captured a mortar. Also, we had a rucksack and to throw another rope. Well, we had ropes when we went up besides the one we climbed on. Then we're stationary ropes, you know, where we climbed.
Yeah.
And they were bigger. He threw that down and started pulling the equipment back up there. And as we got around there, I don't think we even took the time to fill the canteens, you know, but we did We did with a rope tie. I remember getting a can. I says, get that can of water. We need that badge, you know. Yeah. And they pulled it up. Well, on the way up, Ames had called down to the compound and told him the situation, that we had captured some equipment. And
I mean, that's a rare intel find, to get a rucksack, an enemy rucksack. That's always.
It was. And, you know, John, it actually it happened so damn fast.
Sure.
The reaction we did, we didn't realize what the hell we was doing. I think, you know, it's just one of them fast firefights. We've been in.
And you survived it. Your adrenaline's still, like, flowing in the right. system there, particularly now you got done chasing those commies.
Right.
Now you're running back, and you got them. Now, was that the mortar that was firing on the base that night, or was there a separate mortar?
You couldn't really tell that. And
right.
I don't know, because actually, I don't think we actually damaged the mortar when we were shooting M79. I think we just scattered the people,
and
they didn't
loaded
come
them up
back.
With some
so
shrapnel.
It could have been just the same one, you know. Ames had called down to talk, and talks in a Kingbee up.
Right.
The H-34 helicopters.
Yeah, South Vietnamese Kingbee. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Our beloved Kingbees.
Our beloved pilots and Kingbees, right. And they sent a chopper up just as we was starting back up the rope, and just about up to the top whenever they were throwing this stuff on us. Earlier said there's rocks. They couldn't land. They could just hover there,
right.
you know. And Ames jumped on the chopper and says, hey, where are you going? He says, they want me to come down the hill. He says, take over. And I says, okay, I got it. So.
And you gave him the rucksack.
Right. he already had that.
Okay,
they had
right.
pulled up the rucksack.
And, that's critical.
Yeah, they threw all the equipment on there. And you know, the Kingbee, all he had to do, and you know how they used to go in on targets, right down on the pad. Well, we could watch them from there, and they were unloading the stuff, but the pilots was getting out and pointing because they received a lot of fire.
Yeah.
You know, on the Kingbee. You know, we didn't get hit after that the rest of that day.
That's amazing.
It is. I don't know whether it's regrouping or reset. I just didn't know what the situation might be.
Sure.
But that night, we did get hit again, and some way they had picked up a Willie Peter or a White Foster's grenade.
Was it one of ours, do you think?
I think so. I would think so. I didn't even know if they had them.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, they tossed it up there, and a couple of the guys got burnt with it real bad.
Wow.
About the only way they could do us, and a couple of the guys did get hit with shrapnel, you know, from down there. Not critical wounded,
right,
you know.
Right.
And so then that was over, and we just stayed alert the rest of the night. Next morning, it was quiet. But, of course, we recon with far ourselves being on top of them. Still looking down at the compound, seeing guys walking around it, it was devastating. Unimaginable to us at the time, John. One of them days that you don't like to live to see, and you don't realize it's that bad until after over and we start counting the heads, you know?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Then you realize how bad it really was. We started running out of equipment. Not equipment.
Ammo.
Hand
grenades.
Food. You know, we didn't take much with us when we went. So anyway, Colonel Warren, which was our commander at the compound at the time, had got on the radio and was talking to me.
Yeah.
And he said, what do you need up there? And I said, well, send us up Coke, because the indigenous, they liked Coca-Cola, you know.
Oh,
and
of course.
I says, Coke, beer, cigarettes, and as many hand grenades as you can send us, you know, because that was a critical damn piece of...
Yeah. So, if you don't mind, we'll go back to the book for a second here. And again, we're now the morning of the attack, but the attack came at, we'll say for our discussion, 2 a.m. on the morning of August the 23rd. So now sun's coming up, and ever so slowly, night crept towards day. From their perch on Marble Mountain, Larry Trimble and S.T. Rattler could verify the insanity as well as the extent of the carnage and destruction. There were simply too many bodies to count. The supply complex, the old Tok, were leveled and glowing with fire, while the new Tok had been heavily damaged. A pall of dingy smoke floated over the compound. It looked like the recon area had suffered the most extensive damage, with virtually every building having been hit. The whole rolling mess resembled a harshly lit stage setting for a major battle scene. Outside the bunker, Barkley and other SF decided to stay inside the talk, and slowly the gunfire began to ebb, and the satchel charge explosions ceased in the northwestern segment of the base. Nonetheless, Barkley felt it was too quiet and asked his counterpart to look around the corner for NVA troops. No sooner had he moved to that corner when two sappers appeared out of nowhere and charged Barkley's counterpart. The SF soldiers' reflex alone killed them. The two dead NVA landed at Barkley's feet, and he got his boots on their faces just to make sure they weren't moving. Inscribed on the head bandanas of the dead NVA sappers were the words, "We came here to die," and so they did. And then, did you see when Lieutenant Colonel Barr came in with his relief element that came into base later that morning?
No, there were so many people moving around, John. We didn't really see that. You know, as even as I think it, there could have been a possibility, if I can back up just a tad there, of them guys maybe possibly getting to the top of that point. But I had called for help down there when they hit us right after that attack and asked to get some help. They sent Spooky up. And I think Spooky at the time was C-130 with a Gatling gun.
Right. Oh, Spooky was the old C-47.
C-47 is what they were using then.
But they had miniguns. Yeah. That's what counts.
That's right.
Absolutely.
And then popped the Magic Dragon. But yeah, they sent up the Gatling gun and made contact with the pilot. He was calling me. They had given my call sign, and he was calling me and trying to find out where we was. And once he made contact with me, I had, told him I put a strobe light up.
Well, right.
But that strobe light, hell, there's too many other lights. He says, I can't see nothing.
No, is that right?
Right.
Oh, I forgot that part.
I had, John, and we was getting hit pretty hard, but that's why I called for help. You get kind of, you ask for anything you can get to help me, man. I'm in trouble, you know. So anyway, he couldn't see his strobe light, so I had we had C4 with us, cakes. I think they were 2-pound cakes of C4. Well, I took one of them, just broke off pieces and put it on a big rock and lit it. And I says, "Can you see that?" He could. He says, "I got you."
And then you directed gunfire from that.
Right. That's why.
Whoa.
Right. He told us, he says, "If you can, pull together all you can," he says, "because this here has got maybe a 30-meter radius, you know." And I'll tell you what. And we were still being hit, and at the last minute, he said, "Well, tell me when." I pulled the people in, and that's when it got the burp.
Oh, yeah.
And there was all kinds of rocks and everything flying up, you know, on top of us. And none of the people got hit, but I tell you what, it stopped the hell out of the NVA or Zappers or whatever the hell
whatever
it was
coming,
down there.
Right? Yeah.
It did. It stopped them that
so
night.
So that was at what stage of the night did that happen then? This is after you've been going for a few hours, or was it?
Right. They hit us the first time, and that was right when we they had hit the compound, right shortly after that. Well, the second time they hit us, we repelled that. And the second time we hit, it's when I called down and asked for help. I think they had, they had somebody on the radio then, and they got a hold of Da Nang and got that up there. I think Puff the Magic Dragon was already up there dropping
flares
and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's when they come up. It was on that second attack on us.
Yeah, because they again, this is getting back to the morning. Meanwhile, ST Rattler was still stuck on Marble Mountain. There was no sleep in sight for them either. A few hours after sunset, the NVA struck with small arms fire and a rifle-propelled grenade. Several NVA again climbed the ropes in the effort to reach the team, but the Nung recon men killed them before anyone on Team Rattler was injured. Trimble got on the radio, called for air cover. Within a few minutes, Spooky arrived. After Trimble identified himself to the pilot and crew, the airman asked him to light his strobe light to pinpoint the team's location. Unfortunately, the crew members couldn't locate the strobe. As Trimble, ingenious and desperate fellow that he was, cut off a hunk of C4, placed it on top of the highest rock he could find, and ignited it. And off of that, he could direct intense fire. The pilot acknowledged visual contact. Trimble pulled his team, all the team members, into a tight perimeter, hugging the rock. He then told Spooky to work his minigun fire in a 360-degree circle around the rock. As ST Rattler hunkered down, Spooky opened up and performed his magic dragon routine. The initial grounds were so close to the team that they were struck by stones and debris. Spooky continued to walk his fire in an ever-increasing radius around the team, exterminating anything that was unfortunate enough to be in its path. After Spooky expended all its ordnance, the air crew continued to circle above FOB-4 with flares. And so that's that moment in time for you guys. And another attack. And then later you had a radio comma with Warren. By that time, he had received the satchel, your rucksack, the NVA rucksack. Did he say anything that was cryptic to you or caught your attention?
Not a thing. No, nobody told us anything. I kind of got ahead there for a minute. That describes it quite well of what happened with Spooky.
Like they're a lifesaver. Sense of what that night is like.
Yeah.
And you're up there on a mountain and just the significance of close air support, you know,
right.
It's this life-saving. And then again, had they not been there, because they were able to also direct Spooky into camp. That was another aspect
right.
later on. But
yeah.
First and foremost, with you being up there by yourself, just you and your recon team getting low on hand grenades and ammo, here's Spooky.
You betcha.
And we let Spooky march around right. that mountain.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, Larry.
Yeah, you know, I asked him if Ed Abrams was coming back up, and they said, we're going to try to replace him with another man, you know, up there. And I'm not getting ahead of myself this time,
no.
I hope. But anyway,
that's
yeah.
That's critical mass, because
yeah.
you're low on food, you're low on ammo.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And they said they would try to get somebody up there. They had lots of problems themselves down there, which I had understood.
Oh, yeah. I just can't imagine the pandemonium.
And as that next day come, you know.
Well, it's all part of the morning of the 23rd still.
Yes.
Yeah, as it unfolded, yeah.
As it unfolded, and it was later in the day, all the Nungs decided they were going to leave the hill and go back to the compound. And so I told Bing, I says, you know, I want to talk to each one of these guys and
yeah.
see if that's really true.
Yeah.
Each one of them said that they think that they wanted to go, you know. And I called Talk, and this is kind of funny. I don't know who I talked to. They said, well, take their guns and
yeah.
all their equipment and let them go. And I said, you said what? That's what I think I might have said.
Yeah.
But anyway, I talked to each one of the Nungs and asked them, really, is that what they want to try to do? Because I didn't think they'd get off the hill.
Yeah, yeah.
And they decided that that was their choice. The 01 had started talking to the people, and they decided that's what they wanted to do. I told them the only thing I'd like for them to do is leave me all the hand grenades that they could leave me, because that was my best defense.
Sure.
At that location. They took off. I told him I'd give him support as far as long as I could see. You know, hilly, everything, you couldn't really see that well.
Right. And again, you, Sergeant Larry Trimble, are alone on the mountaintop at Marble Mountain. Your little people leave. You're the sole man. Low on ammo.
Right.
A few extra hand grenades just for good luck. And that's just that moment, Todd. I just can't imagine feeling like the Lone Ranger without Tonto.
Later on, I really did. Not at the time, I didn't. I just started resetting claymores. I did start getting as much stuff to where I could get to it.
Sure.
And actually, there was actually two locations that they could have come up. The others was just, I didn't think they could make it.
Right. So you hit the obvious areas first, place your claymores,
I did.
Come back with your debt cord, have them in a handy right. location.
Within, I think, and you know time, I can't give time, but...
Because it's warped.
It is. Point. Today it is.
And, oh, yeah. Well, that too. I mean, that's old age, but I mean, even when you're under right. fire, under attack for hours
right.
by sappers, and you're working spooky, bringing deadly fire yeah. within 10 feet of your perimeter, my God.
Well, I started here. I heard a firefight going on, and...
Yeah, on Marble Mountain.
Right. I could not see our people, but I had supposed they'd run into trouble.
Well, your ears were keen enough then. You couldn't hear them now, but 53 years ago, you could tell the difference between AK fire and Car 15 fire.
Probably.
Probably, yeah.
I can't remember.
I'll give you credit for that, Larry.
Thank you. But I couldn't really help support them, and I would have, you know.
Of course. You just couldn't see them.
Couldn't see them. They... It wasn't before long that Bing, the interpreter, started hollering up, Tung Si, Tung Si. And I said, yeah.
And Tung Si is Vietnamese for sergeant.
Right.
Yeah.
And he says, we want to come back. Can we come back? And I said, no.
What did he say?
it just got quiet. I do remember it got quiet for a while. And my thought was, 100 things going through my mind, like, man, if they was in a firefight, they got anybody captured, hell, maybe they're going to try to set an ambush for me.
Because the other aspect of R.T. Rattler, where did those personnel come from? That's another side of Rattler that we've never talked about before. Weren't they trained when they came from where?
The Nungs?
They were strictly Nungs, though.
They weren't
the NVA Nungs at Chu Hoi.
No.
No, okay.
They come out of Chulai Street in Saigon.
Okay.
Down there in Hardham. Paid him. I forgot how much money we used to pay him.
More many. Than what the regular army or the Arvin would have paid him.
Right, yes. Yeah. Right. But it got quiet. You know, after a while, I said, will you come up here and bring that 01, the leader of
your
team.
Vietnamese yeah. counterpart.
Right. They come up and we talked. Just they didn't come all the way up. I was still.
Yeah, because you had to be careful.
I was still worried of that. We talked, and they promised. They said, we come back, we fight, we stay with you till the end, you know. And so I let them. I said, okay.
Wow.
They come up, and I did. I called back and told them, you know, down to talk. Told them that they did come back, you know, so we got full support, you know, from mm-hmm. them now, I'm sure. And I says, what about that American?
Yeah, and the resupply.
And the resupply, too.
Sure.
And, the other American, and you know what, John, I do not remember his name. I've tried to battle my mind to remember. I cannot remember who he was. But they sent him up, and of course the choppers, like I say, had to hoover.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were pushing off the boxes of ammo and everything, you know, and the rations and stuff. It says hoover. And it wasn't that far up, but the American jumped off, and he twisted his leg, yeah. You know, anyway.
Really bad.
Bad.
He couldn't hike.
He could not hardly move, you know. So actually, he was still a great asset to me because he was able to operate the radio,
yeah.
Keep contact with the...
let you focus on the mission. Let him focus on the radio comms.
Right. We did have one kind of a funny thing happen, maybe.
In the middle of all that.
Yeah, well, this was the next night, the last night.
Okay.
There. I shouldn't say it was early in the night.
Mm-hmm.
And on the the concertina wire and stuff we had up a protection from the mountain, you know, and
right.
the compound.
Down at the base.
They had plenty of people down there, and I seen movement down there, you know, going into the wire, you know.
Right.
And so I called down, and they had radio contact all the way around. Each one of them had contact on my frequency up there. And I told them that they were getting ready to get hit on that there wall right there. And so Band-Aid just fired the hell out of it, you know, and everything.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
No kidding.
Well, the next morning, they sent a team out, and I was looking down, you know, with binoculars.
Yeah, sure.
Looking down, and I said, they were saying, well, tell us where they're at. Did we get any or something, you know? And I said, yeah, they're laying there down there. And so I started directing them and said, hell, that's a bush. You know, they walked over. The only thing I can figure, well, guess what? You know, all this time and everything going on, he didn't sleep much, and I was taking the Green Hornets.
Yeah. Ooh.
All of the people was taking bennies to stay awake with. We carried them. You know, the only thing we didn't let them carry, of course, was the Surrettes.
Right.
And each American carried, I think, 5 Surrettes is what I wanted.
Yeah, per packet. They had the cardboard packing, you had 5 Surrettes
yeah,
in.
Yeah, and but I wouldn't let
morphine Surrettes.
Right, morphine. Didn't want the indigenous to carry that stuff because they'd take it downtown when they got home, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Big time. So anyway, I think that I was seeing things, you know. But and I don't talk about that much because at first that guy said, hell, man, what's wrong with you, Tramboys? But, you know, things do happen.
Oh, they do. And it better be safe than sorry, because if you weren't sure, is this an optical illusion or not, you've directed the proper course of action. And they, either Viet Cong or Bushes were very dead.
Very well could have been.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
So how much longer were you up there? Because the attacks on you went up the 21st, the attacks the morning of the 23rd, you were there throughout the 24th.
25th and the 26th morning, they were able to pull us out. Wow. They did send a hatchet force team.
Really?
They sent that from the compound. I'm not quite sure what day, but they sent that before the Nungs took off and tried to relieve us up there.
They
got hit. They turned around, went back to the compound. So that was in between sometime, John. I can't remember.
I know. But that's still indicative that there are still people in Marble Mountain underneath y'all. Because what we didn't realize at the time was how extensive the tunneling was.
Right.
We learned later that they had a hospital facility there, a kitchen, and there were several levels that we just didn't realize. Our intel reports. Of course, let's get back to intel for a second, or lack of it. Because on that night, as we've all learned later from one of your former teammates, Gene Pugh, who was on comm that night, and I guess it would be earlier in the week, Gene was on. But he received a message saying, attack imminent. Called a flash message, which is the top most urgent priority communication. That came either from the agency or from another unit. And then Bill Barkley had another. Oh, no, there's another sergeant had the same message. And then night of August 22nd, Bill Barkley. So there's three messages that said attack imminent, and Barkley took it directly to Colonel Warren, said, right, look at this message, and Colonel Warren said, Major Moore has everything under control, we don't have to worry. Famous last words.
Right. But I did not hear any of this. Sent up to me. I probably wouldn't have changed our plan up there because we was alert anyway, you know.
Yeah, you can't go too far in that little spot of land.
But we had not been alerted of that it was an imminent attack period, you know, or going to happen. And it did. Today I feel very fortunate. At the time I just did what I thought we was
trained for.
You
marched on. So when you finally get down the mountain, there was a little surprise. When did you learn about the rucksack and the content therein?
That's when I learned about it. As I got down, we had 3 indigenous that they sent straight to the dispensary for injuries. There was an American that led me down to the hooch. My hooch had been
destroyed.
Destroyed. Because Lily, the dog I had,
right,
she got killed in that.
The dog was KIA, yeah, so we should make it 17 and go back to 17. I forgot the dog.
She's a good dog. I got her from somebody else. I'd have never named her Lily. But that was the name she went by. But damn good dog, you know. And she lived in the hooch, and she'd sleep under my bunk. So she was in there when they threw a satchel charge in there.
Another casualty of war.
I would say so. I thought so. She's a good lot of... As good as a lot of men, you know. good dog. But they took me my hooch, and they did give me a shot to get so I could rest, because my eyes was just almost like glued open.
Sure.
You know, they called the medic, come down, give me a shot to rest. And I slept for I don't know how long. Her, you know, fell dead. Well, later on, actually, when they called me up for a debriefing, you know, of everything that happened up there right after that, is whenever they told me that they had got a word from the Marines that they would like to see the team on the hill.
Whoa. No kidding.
Yeah. So they sent a 3/4 ton over, picked us up. It was at the Marine Amphibious Outfit.
Yeah, sure.
Sent a truck over.
Because they were on the other side of Marble Mountain.
Right, picked me and the team up, the Nungs, and carried us back over. Carried us to the officers' club. And the Marines do live good, too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so.
Particularly in the officers' club, at least.
Right, yeah. It was the officers' club. they was going to cook a barbecue for us, you know, and took us in, and they said that they'd like to have us all sign their welcome board, you know, that they have. Well, hell, them damn Nungs thought they're celebrities after that. You know? Getting to sign their name to it.
And a good meal.
And a good meal. And, of course, what they wanted to drink was a Coca-Cola.
Of course.
And I got to drink all the
good
whiskey
stuff.
I could. But anyway, John, that was very, I'll always remember that as a Marine. Good brothers.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Absolutely.
Always.
And then, with all that, where did your career in the Army begin?
Decatur, Illinois.
1956.
Whoa. I was born 1939. 1 month later, that was October the 2nd, I think, or right at that, I went into the Army. I walked by a billboard up there. They used to have...
right by the post office.
That's where they had the recruiting command for the Army.
Yeah.
And walking by there, I seen that paratrooper jumping in out, you know.
Yeah.
And I said, that's what I want to do. And then you had to have your parents sign for you, of course.
Because you're only 17.
Right. And I asked my mother, I said, would you sign for me? I want to join the paratroopers. And she said, no. You ain't going... And I am paratroopers, and so I said, well, I want to go in the Army anyway. And I'm kind
of
saying what I remember.
Yeah,
that's hard to remember back then. But anyway, she signed for me going to the Army. I went to St. Louis, and then they took us on down to Fort Jackson. Not Fort Jackson, that's where we ended up. In Missouri. Leonardwood.
Leonardwood,
Fort Leonardwood, where they had us and assigned everybody to a job. I was assigned to go through basic at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. And the first airplane ride I'd ever took in my life.
Is that right?
Yeah. They flew us down there. And then, of course, through basic, they asked, we had already been assigned to where we would take our, what they started calling second 8 weeks. They didn't call it that then.
Right.
They just said your training and where you, what you'd be doing.
Which later became AIT.
Right. And they had a recruiter there for jump school. And of course, I wrote a letter to my mother and said, well, I'm going to go to airborne school.
Did you trick her enough there? She didn't realize that airborne was parachuting?
I don't know, John. I thought I did.
You being anyway, so clever.
Yeah, they did. My mother and father both come to graduation, jump school graduation.
Wow.
After that, I went in.
And jump school was then Fort Benning or Bragg?
No, Fort Bragg.
Wow. But it's still to drive from Decatur.
Right. I think one of our guys there was Bloody Burns. Does that name recall?
Not for me.
He was one of the cadre that run us, you know, for jump school.
Sure.
Man, that guy could run. You
know? Ran your legs off.
He'll kill us all.
Oh, yeah.
But then after jump school, I went on a third packet to Germany, to the 11th Airborne Division.
Mm-hmm.
I stayed there until they were we went, you know, we had an episode in 1958. We just got back from Hornfield about the middle of the year, and we was alerted that we was going to be moving, and we didn't know where we was going. We went to First and Fellbrook, set up, and in the middle of the night, they said, load the airplane, load your ammunition, your weapon stuff. We was on a C-119, and we was one of the last ones to fly out, and they put extra ammunition on our craft. We landed in Italy and got a meal at the mess hall, and then we went back flying again. We ended up in Adana, Turkey. And we had stopped there. We was all out underneath the wings. And,
sure.
And the pilot come out. But we had a question to ask him. When we was flying, everybody had just taken off their chutes, you know, and just
right.
set them back. You know, well, we had the Mae West underneath them. They tried to teach us that real fast. Said, don't unhook before you inflate that damn thing. So anyway, it was actually late anyway. It was dark, and we was across the Mediterranean when we was flying before we got into Udorn, and the doors open, red light was on.
Yeah. So you know you're all standing in the door,
and they
got your parachutes on, and you're ready to jump.
Well, they said hook up, and if you can get a hold of any boxes in the middle, which was extra ammo and rations, they started tossing them out the door. Then after a bit, you know, everything calmed down. It settled. The pilot was losing altitude. And so when he come out, you know, we was all underneath the wing and we was talking to him about it. We said, well, damn, man, why didn't he? It was dark. We was jumping. If we'd have jumped, we was in water. And it says he was going to drop us. And I remember him saying, you know, we wouldn't have crashed with you guys in it because that C-119 would sink like a dollar, you know.
Plunk. Oh, yeah.
And so anyway, another close call.
Whoa. So what was your destination? Did you ever find out?
We went to Beirut, Lebanon.
No kidding.
Yes. We did not jump in.
Right.
We air landed. We set up, and I was in the... It was a 187th, and I was in A Company, I'm pretty sure. And we got set in up at Jamor. That's up at one of the mountains right on the border. And they set us up. It was a college up there, or a university or something, in Beirut.
Right.
We got set up there. Anyway, we spent 3 months there. And the reason I know it was 3 months was because the old man had always... You know, they carried a safe with them, you know, the company commanders.
Right.
And we had to donate, you know, on payday so much money because that's when the new uniforms, the green uniforms, was coming out, the Class A's. Well, we would have to buy a new equipment, you know.
No.
And when we got back,
you know,
new uniform. We found out as we got back anyway that... if you're in it, what they considered that was a combat zone, even though we was not in combat, you know.
Right.
So we got a complete new issue at no charge of equipment. Anyway, I didn't mean to get off on that, but
from
my career.
You go forward, and then how do you wind up learning about SF, and what drew you to SF, Special Forces?
I went back to the 101st Airborne Division. Went to Vietnam with them the first trip. We went over by boat.
What year was this? 65?
It was 64, 65.
Right.
We crossed the international date line twice.
No kidding.
We had the whole brigade on the boat with attachments, which I think was right at around 3,600 people. We was elbow to elbow one there, and we crossed the international date line. I think took 21 days to get over to Vietnam.
Oh, man, is that right?
We landed in Cam Ranh Bay.
Right.
We debarked. We started walking. And we would challenge anybody then because we're so happy to get off that boat. Yeah. Anyway, after I come back, I said, no more conventional units for me.
Yeah.
And they were recruiting for the SF. They were recruiting for the SF at that time. And that's right after that's when I went through school.
Training group?
Training group, yeah.
Wow, back to Bragg, go through training group?
Yes.
And so then when you complete the training, what's your MOS?
11 Bravo SG for German. I could say
Wüste. Deutsch, huh? Yeah.
Gesuten or something like that, you know. But that was my MOS.
Wow. So what was your first group assignment then? What year was that? 67 then? 68?
68?
Yeah.
Was SOG. After we graduated, I got with orders to Vietnam, and of course, we was going through the assignments at Nha Trang, and they had signed me to down at Charlie Company, out down around Charlie Company, and
right,
as I'm not sure,
yeah,
but I know as I was walking away, I said, oh, damn, and those guys had heard about SOG by then.
Well, is that right?
Yeah, and I said, man, I'd like to have gotten SOG. And that personnel guy said, what'd you say? And that's how I got to sign the SOG.
No kidding. So then you come to the FOB 4?
Yes.
You get there what, in the spring then or in the summer? Before?
Late spring.
Late spring, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, so you and I came in country at the same time. I landed pretty at the close. End of April.
Yeah, pretty close.
Yeah, we went up to FOB 1, you went to 4.
Yeah.
We may have even been in the same briefing, Larry.
Probably.
Yeah, welcome to the Secret War from there. And so then how many years after your completion of the tour, you de-roast, you go home, 69, and then what's the next step in your career? Because how many years were you in all together?
I spent 21 years. I retired in 78, March of 78, with the 5th Group at Fort Bragg.
Oh, is that right?
Yes.
Wow, before they transferred up to Fort Campbell back in the
right.
day.
It was before.
And you survived all that rift, the reduction in force period of time that came through in the 70s. That's saying something because a lot of people, after the buildup, mm-hmm. by 1970, they went into the reduction of force because in, I guess it would be the summer of 69, that the peak manpower was 546,000 Americans. In Vietnam. Of course, 1 out of 10 actually was in combat. The rest were support elements.
Yes, sir.
Of one kind or another.
Right.
And then, but from that buildup, they had to reduce the reduction in force, which means get rid of people, as many as they can, to get out, either force them out, men getting losing rank,
time they did.
Grade, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Did you get hit up with that any, or were you able to retain your rank?
No, I was fine.
So when you retired in 78, your rank was?
E7.
Is that right?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's saying something that time.
Yeah.
And then from there, 78, then what?
That's probably why they didn't catch up with me. I retired, like I said, in 78, and I worked for the government another 21 years.
Doing what?
I was a construction safety inspector for Arizona first. I was on the, you know, the canal that they put through the Arizona there anyway. And Granite Reef, I think they might have called it. I can't remember. Then I went to California as their safety manager for all of the construction in California, all the dams and stuff.
Sure.
And then I retired from that in 1999.
Wow. And then somewhere along the line, you joined the Special Operations Association.
Yes, I joined it. My number, I think, is about 165 or something like that.
You're real early.
Yeah.
Indeed.
They had just been, I think, what, probably 81? Does that sound about right, I think, John?
Well, it was formed in 1976. Jim Butler and a couple of other CCN guys, so the recon guys, put together Special Operations Association.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why I mentioned it was that while you're doing everything else, you eventually became the director for the Special Operations Association riders, who over several years did numerous fundraisers that raised thousands of dollars for the SOA, which was directed towards the Bright Light Fund, which was for helping veterans to come to the reunion, basically.
Right.
Because there were some of our guys that just couldn't afford it. So thanks to you, we were able to get them to come out. In addition to that, if they needed care, they could pay for their care person, or if whether it's a wife or a nurse.
Right.
Because there were some key people that came who otherwise wouldn't have been able to, but thanks to the riders. So you did that for a bunch of years. So talk, just that's a little bit of a fun sidelight, but it's interesting, you know. You formed them up, and then you, each year you had one or two fundraisers every year, as I recall, right?
We did that, and we would ride once a year together. Our first ride was back to the wall.
Right.
We placed a wreath back there, and we'd have a short memorial. And then different states start asking us to come to different towns.
Oh, is that right?
Got word to us.
I forgot that part of
it. That's the way it started.
I just thought you all just called and said, hey, we want to come do a thing. And he goes, man, I didn't realize the states called you up too.
So all us, well, it actually wasn't the states. It was individual organizations that had heard about us.
Right.
And in fact, we went to Branson. Bill set that one up for us, Bill Brother.
Yeah.
And the guy where we had the memorial, we used to read off the names of the guys that got killed. And everybody would give a flower. John, I believe you made the one when it was in California. And I
indeed, very touching ceremony. It.
And so we had the same ceremony all the time. You know, was we would always honor those guys that got killed on the 23rd of August.
Absolutely.
To me, that was so important.
Sure.
Still today is.
Absolutely. And you know, we had the 20th anniversary, the 50th anniversary of August 23rd, 68, which they had a reunion. We attended that, and there we paid homage to those men.
Yes.
And for the first time, we met family members of those who were killed in action that night.
Yes.
And it was quite a moving ceremony, a breakfast, and then they stayed for the whole reunion. And just talking to some of the family members was such an incredible experience. But you were a key part of all that.
Yeah, I believe that Bonnie Cooper was kind of our.
She's the go-to
person.
Lady. Yes.
She was, and she I believe
she's a
there
secret
was,
resource for the SOA.
And I'm pretty sure there was 69 kin, family kin that got to go to that.
Yes.
Grandkids, kids, and stuff like that.
That's right.
Wonderful. If I may bring this up,
please
about
bring it up. That's why we're here.
Me and Susan, my wife, was sitting at the table. And this guy come up behind me, you know, and tapped me on the shoulder, and he says, Larry. And I turned around and looked, and I stood up, and him and his wife was standing there. He says, you remember me? And I says, no, I don't remember you. And he says, when we went through training group together. And
training group together?
Right. He said, you was a staff sergeant then. And he says, there were three or four of us that kind of tied in with you because we figured if you made it, well, we could make it then, you know. Because it was rough back then, I thought, anyway. And so we talked a few minutes, and he had went to Vietnam right after we got out of training group. And then he went to work for the FBI as a criminal investigator. And I said, oh, that's great. I said, what are you doing now? And he said, well, he says, I retired, but they called me up and asked me if I could come back. And as he left, we shook hands. The wives talked for a minute, you know.
Sure,
and,
sure.
And he gave me one of his coins, you know, challenge coins. I thought that it has his number on it, but didn't have his name. And damn, to this day, I can't remember what it was. But anyway, I didn't mean to get off on that. I just,
well,
that's
pretty cool,
know.
Because even there, you had like a, because of your experience and time in the Army, there were men that turned to you. You didn't even realize it, but they were following your footsteps to get the training group, which then was very rigorous.
He remembered my name, and his wife said, but you're almost every night talking at the dinner table. As a joke, I think. Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. And through the SOA, we go back to our time at CCN, FOB4, because at the end of 68, FOB4 became CCN. They consolidated the six FOBs. So CCN was for North, CCC was Kantoon, Central, and South was the third. And you had some pretty good memorable experiences there, too, with some of the men that were there, and as well as some of the men that we lost along the way. And people just forget that secret war, the casualty rate was formidable. And, of course, in March of 69, one name that comes to mind is Ricardo Davis.
Oh, Ricardo, yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's like you and Ricardo, in my mind, I didn't realize how old you guys were. So when I get to CCN, I see Ricardo. I always assumed he was an E3 or an E4, just a common guy. So one day we had a formation. He's wearing E7 stripes, and you had E6 stripes. So I'm going, you know, you had to earn those things by time and grade. Mm-hmm. So you two were people I looked up to instantly, realizing that you'd been in that long. Yeah. I just had been promoted to buck sergeant. And, of course, I entered the country. Unlike you, who entered the country as a sergeant or a staff sergeant, I came in as a knee deuce. So I was a little bit not as powerful as you. But Ricardo, some of the other people there, did you say that you also had that experience where somebody got a picture of you with Martha Ray? You could talk about Martha a little bit, too, as one of our saints.
Right. I do. Have a picture.
And you didn't realize it, right?
I did not realize whoever gave that picture, but my youngest boy, Bradley, he was teaching these kids at this school, and the school was for kids that was having a hard time, you know, in life, and was their last chance before juvenile, I think. And anyway, Brad was wearing one of our riding shirts, and the kid says, "Oh, you was in the war. What war was that, you know?" And of course, Brad told him and said, "Well, that's not me. That's my father was in the war." And they said, "Well, what's his name?" And he said, "Larry Trimble." Well, the kids come back to school the next day. They had gotten on the internet and found a picture of me.
Wow.
And Martha Ray. When I give her one of our windbreakers that we used to have.
Sure. And the 101 windbreaker, black 10. You pulled it on the top.
Yeah.
Some had snaps with the hood.
Right. Also, yeah. A K-bar.
Oh, is that right?
Yes. You know, I got a whole box of them K-bars because I told you about that knife it broke into. It's kind of like the one Tom had made for you that we got from the triangle. Well, that when they threw that my load-bearing equipment down to me up there on Marble Mountain, that knife went ploop.
No.
Well.
Was it made in China?
I think so. Anyway, there was one of the CBs over there, you know, and so I made a deal with him for a couple of bottles of booze, you know, for a case of K-bars.
You didn't trade him one of those Viet Cong flags that our people thought up with ketchup and gave it to him?
No. Then was some pretty good fun days, too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we had our times there.
So what was the event? Do you remember what the event was when you were with Martha Ray? You might explain a little bit. Martha Ray, by the way, was an actress who became an honorary Green Beret from dozens of tours of coming into in-country, working with special forces, entertaining. But sometimes she'd be in base when they came under fire, and she was a qualified nurse. And she would help out the medics doing some of the triage and treating some of the people, and thus earned her honorary Green Beret, which there are not many women that have one.
That's true. Indeed. She was Colonel Martha Ray.
Yes, indeed. That's what they gave her rank. And I guess she had been in the reserves or something, so she had legitimate Army rank.
Right. It's just Colonel, Colonel.
And, no kidding.
And we used to talk all the time. You know, her drink was vodka and water.
Vodka and water?
Yeah.
Oh.
And
she used to
come all the time up there, and she started bringing this lady with her, Frenchie.
Right.
And Frenchie started working for the underground. Her boy and also her husband in Germany during World War II was killed by the Nazis.
Right.
She went into the underground and started working for the English, you know, jumping in and getting people out, you know.
Right.
And that was kind of her history, but I guess the Gestapo was waiting on him on a drop zone one time. Word got out she was put in a concentration camp, and when the Americans liberated her, well, she fell in love with America, you know.
Yeah.
And so she come in, and, you know, she got her and Martha Ray met some way, and, you know, I don't know if you remember, John, she used to come, Frenchie'd come up to the, with Martha Ray, up to the SOG conventions.
Well, yeah, those were the days before I began attending a lot of the conventions.
And yeah.
Like, she came to CCN at least two or three times during my tour of duty. Each time I was either at the launch site or in a target.
Yeah.
I never, you know, you and Ricardo Davis and the other guys all had your photo ops.
Right.
And she was just an amazing lady. She just loved Special Forces.
She would. And, you know, everybody always say Maggie's drawers, you know.
Yeah.
Every time she'd come in, she'd bring a little bikini, you know, and they'd pin it up behind the bar, you know.
Yeah, is that right?
I remember them days.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, of course, you know, she really got to know Ricardo Davis. And
really
when
well.
We lost Ricardo in March of 69,
yep.
she came back. She was there for the service, I'm told, because, again, I was up at Quang Tri, and she just wept.
Yeah.
You know, she really, really missed it because he's such a character.
Yeah, she's a one-of-a-kind woman.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And she loved the Special Forces, and I believe she is buried at Fort Bragg.
Correct.
Yes.
Yes, with high honors.
High honors, because there ain't many women buried there.
Well, we've gone through anything else going back and looking at that fateful night of August 23rd, 1968, that perhaps you'd want to get covered or just to reflect on or things? Because sometimes when you and I get talking, like the first interviews I ever did with you for an article for Soldier of Fortune, it was different than the one I interviewed for On the Ground because you remembered more. And then after that, there's been a subsequent follow-up for the Sentinel, which is the SFA Chapter 78 newsletter. And again, every time I interview you, there's surprises. So for book four, we're going to put all your surprises together and redo the that attack.
There we
that
go.
Night. But, so if you got anything else, Larry, fess up right now, buddy.
Well, that, you're going to have to catch me wind.
Have to come to a ready ambush you at night, huh?
Yeah.
After that second beer.
You know, I at one time said that I'd never fail what the hell I did, you know.
Right,
over
right.
There.
Yeah.
But I did. When you talked me into it, and I think that was up at Jim Lamont's house.
That's right.
And we, me, you, and
Bill was there. Bill Werther was
Bill
there.
Bill was there. But who was the guy that wrote the book on Uncommon Valor?
Oh,
Bucket. Well, Bucket. Remember Bucket? He sat with us and had a drink.
Oh.
And there was four of us sat there.
There's two Uncommon Valors. One was by Stephen Moore.
Okay, this Bucket.
He's a friend. He was a cousin or a nephew of George Hunt, who ran Recon out of CCC.
Yeah.
And he focused on CCC missions.
Okay, this is somewhat different.
Jack Singlob was there. General.
He was there also.
Yes, and his lovely wife.
Because we got all the books we could carry.
Indeed.
You know, back. In fact, I left out of Colorado. Me and Sue was going to go up to, what is that, bike
up to
ride?
IP.
No, we was going up. We was, what is that?
Well,
every year, Sturgis. We was going to go to Sturgis.
Oh, okay, sure.
So we stopped by to see her sister in Colorado. Well, Jim Lamont called me up and asked me if I'd come up, you know.
Yeah.
There's going to be a few people up there. That's how I got to win. General Simlob went and, all of them said, take all the books you can take.
Oh, no kidding.
Well, Bucket had, he did all of that exposing people that wasn't, remember?
Right, yeah.
Can't think of
Stolen
his first.
Stolen Valor.
Stolen Valor. Okay,
right.
That's
it. I'll think of the
Not
name
uncommon.
Of the author in a second. I haven't talked to him in years, but he was there, right? And then we had Baby Son.
Baby Son did come
was
in,
there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I said, no, he got killed.
It's Jug Burkett. Jug Burkett was the author of Stolen Valor.
Right.
Co-authored it, and it's the most astounding book that detailed Stolen Valor from so many people that rip off the VA.
Right.
And other people that wannabes that pretend to be veterans, including some really big-name actors.
Right.
Yeah, just scumbags.
His book is a good book.
Fabulous book. And he was there. I forgot about Jug.
Right. Yes. And because I asked him, where'd you get that name, Bucket? He said, my dad and mom called me it's that ever. Pence. I said, but they called him Bucket, though.
I forgot that part.
Oh, yeah. We was having a good time up there.
Oh, yeah.
And a great time.
Well, yeah. And one of the reasons we had that meeting was called together was because at that point in time, it was 6 years after we had the CCN, the Communist News Network, and Warner Brothers did the erroneous lies story about Operation Tailwind. And so Operation Tailwind was one of the most successful SOG missions from September 11 to 14, 1970, where we had 16 Green Berets, 120 indigenous that went in to relieve the CIA. And out of that mission, of the 16 Green Berets, there were 32 Purple Hearts issued. And then on October 23rd, 2017, Gary Mike Rose received the Medal of Honor.
Right.
Because he was the sole medic on that. And the reason we had the meeting in 2004 was a follow-up because they did not offer corrections and they had a limited apology and limited corrections. And they were discussing with Jim Moriarty, who was a complete stud for us. He was Jim Moriarty, for anybody who hasn't had the pleasure of meeting that young Marine to this day, he's just got that fool of Marine spirit, but he was a door gunner for three tours of duty with the Marines, two or three of which they were attached to SOG.
Right, right.
Because Scarface and other Marine units were attached to us throughout the eight-year secret war. And so Jim got to know us, and when this happened, Jim jumped in and did pro bono work, supporting our guys, suing CNN and Warner Brothers. And at 2004, they were preparing a major litigation. And then they went forward with that, and they were talking about possible movies and things like that, all of which disappeared once some of the court settlements happened. And they're all top secret. So anybody who got money or might have got money, it was all without anybody saying I did anything wrong, but we'll just give them a large chunk of funds here. But Jim Moriarty was a stud on that. And of course, there's just a side note on Jim. His boy Jimmy entered the Special Forces, became a proud member of the 5th Special Forces Group, and tragically was one of three Green Berets killed in Jordan in November of 2016. And just last month, I believe, or March, Jimmy was posthumously awarded the Silver Star.
Cool.
Absolutely.
Great.
And that was right. Jim's only son. And so, a little sidebar on a sidebar there, but he's always been there for the SF people.
Yeah.
And he's also recently worked behind the scenes to help Paris Davis, who was an officer, get his Medal of Honor. And when he was in Vietnam, amongst other people he saved was Billy Wall. Yeah. And during that combat, he earned and was put in for the Medal of Honor twice, and twice the Army, quote, lost the paperwork.
Oh, yeah.
There we go. Yeah. But and there, Jim Moriarty, once again, with a couple of other key volunteers, and Neil Thorne, who's a National Guardman, who's helped the Special Operations Association over the last 12 to 15 years, help people to get awards that they were rightly earned, but the command elements were just too busy to take care of that.
Right.
But that's another sidebar. So anything else, sir, upon reflections here, any final words of wisdom or certainly no regrets, but or anything? So let's close out here before we close.
Okay, just one thing.
Please.
If I can remember anything else before I buy the farm, John, I promise you, before you do your book, I'll let you know.
Oh, that's good.
And I just want to thank you for being here today and try to open the door up to the American people of, the SOG, which we do have classified operations today still.
Indeed. There are still spec ops going on, and we have special forces teams around the world, and we can't talk about it because it's top secret. But it's not like... The key thing that people forget about Special Forces, we work with people to help them better their lives.
Airborne.
And the SF motto is De Oppresso Liber, to free the oppressed, and we live by that motto.
We do.
So at this point in time, I want to say all of this, SOGcast 5, We owe a big thank you to Jocko Willink and his right-hand man, Echo Charles. And without that sponsorship and their outstanding drinks, like their Go Energy drinks, we thank them. And as we close out, we also want to thank all of our service members today who are out there defending our country one way or another, whether it's the Army, Navy, Air Force, Coast Guard, Marine Corps, yes, indeed. And now we have the Space Force out there. And then we have to add all of our first responders, and particularly during the last year, the first responders and anybody that's out in the field helping our people that are sick. We just salute all of you. With that, we close for today. Thank you for joining us, Larry. It was an honor to have you here with us. Until next time. So welcome to the post-show interview here. I'm joined by our current mystery man, Tom the Technician, who is serves us quite well. We thank him for his replicating services like Echo Serves, Jocko. We have Tom the Mystery Man that works for us here at SOGcast. And so, Tom, you've been here for the first four SOGcasts. It'll be part of our history here. What about number episode 5 with Sergeant Trimble? Is that a man or a man?
Definitely a man.
Oh, my God.
I mean, you're up on a mountain by yourself?
Yeah.
Your indiges just decide,
I'll
hey,
now.
I'm done. What do you mean you're done? We're not done. We got a mission to complete.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I can relate to some of that. Like, oh, we're done. No, no, there's work to do.
Yeah.
You can't just leave. No, we can. No. But in that predicament, I mean, you have nowhere to go.
Yeah.
Like, you're up on top. People are below you throwing hand grenades at you. And a white phosphorus hand grenade at that.
And then they had mortared the camp on top of that.
They're mortaring the people below you. And you, I mean, it's got to be a feeling of, we need to take care of this, but I'm helpless. I'm watching these guys on the ground. I'm watching these guys in that camp. I'm seeing the chaos. I'm seeing it. And I can't do anything. Oh, not to mention, while that's going on, I'm getting attacked.
Yeah.
So I'm watching this. I'm getting attacked. And then I'm out of water.
And there's no warning. There's no intel reports to say attack imminent.
Oh. There was. But nobody let anybody know that there was an attack imminent.
Yeah, the base commander and his other major buddy just said, oh, no, we got it under control. The village is not, they're not hostile.
Not at all.
Oh, yeah. Very good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be interesting to go. I think it would be kind of really interesting to go to Marble Mountain and see.
People have done it.
And see what it looks like.
People have done that. Spider Parks has been back. Dan Thompson.
And go in it.
Who was on Rhode Island later. Both of them have been back. And Doug Gottschall, who's now president of the Special Operations Association, I believe went back at a separate occasion. And Dan and Spider, I forget if Doug had been on this, but they at separate times met the Buddhist monks, and they went down. They had a whole... I don't want to say a religious service, but it was a spiritual service where they acknowledged all those who were killed on both sides of the battle.
Yeah.
And when Spider was there, Robert J. Spider Parks, who was the 1-0 of my team, later flew Covey, and on the night of that attack, he came into FOB4 on the night of the 22nd, took Pat Watkins, what was it? He took a 9mm submachine gun with him to go downtown to the safe house.
Yeah.
And he missed the battle, but came back in the morning and oversaw it with the damage and what had gone on. And then he did some help with the cleanup and whatnot.
Yeah, because your book really outlines, you know, on the ground, when you read that and you take in the guys that were there. You take in the stories of the guys, you know, sleeping in their racks, and then all of a sudden getting woken up and then walking down the hall. I could still picture, like, literally visualize that. But it's like, you did a great job, like, telling that story from the ground and then listening to this and listening to another aspect of it, plus another aspect of stuff that was missed in the books because it changes. So it was interesting to, you know, you read the book, you get that kind of sense of what it was like, but then you listen to this and you listen to Larry talk about what it was like up there, and it changes everything, because you get that personal relationship to what it was like. And it wasn't just, you know, oh, we were up on top of this mountain. Like, I didn't realize how much they went up here. Then they had to climb the ropes, and then they had to get this, you know. And I don't know if I'd felt comfortable doing what you guys did. Like, going up on top, and you have tunnels below you.
Oh, yeah.
And you don't know what's in them. I mean, I don't know how deep they went in to recon those, but I'm guessing you didn't go real deep. But at the same point, what do you know? Who are the monks hiding? Like you guys said, the monks... Were they for you or were they against you?
Deep down inside, you knew they probably weren't.
Exactly.
But you just couldn't come out and say that.
But then you sit there and you look at those tunnels and it's like, you can hide anything in there. I mean, there could have been a battalion in there.
He mentioned the hatchet force that came back.
And they couldn't
get out. They got hammered. They took casualties. I don't know if we had any KIAs. And I know one of the, I don't know if that was the effort where one of the, a lieutenant actually went into a couple of the caves, and he was KIA. Yeah. He had a hard time getting his body out.
Was it the hatchet force was 40?
Could be anything from a platoon to a company.
Yeah.
And that's, so it may have been a platoon size operation. And so on that occasion, and then a few days later, they tried another effort. And again, people got wounded up there.
What happened to the Marine? That was the one thing I didn't... They got hit.
We don't know. They shut him down because Larry never heard from...
Yeah, the comm never came back.
Yeah.
When he reached out.
We assume they took the radio.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, I wasn't sure on that. But, exceptional story. I mean, again, the courage and heroic acts that you guys did on a daily basis over there is... I mean, it's to me, it's just unfathomable. I just can't even think of it in today's realm of things. One, I can't see any officer out there who's willing to sign up. Say, we're going to send this one guy with these 8 indig up to the top of the mountain by himself, or with another American. But then we're going to take that American and leave him there by himself. The risk that it takes, you know, you guys took a huge amount of risks in everything you did, and it shows a lot of just that internal thing that you wonder where that is today.
Right.
Because it's very few.
They just had that movie that came out. Anna and I just saw it for the first time, but where they put that, like a small company into the valley, and they kept getting warnings, you're going to get attacked. Nobody believed that they got attacked.
That was Outpost, yeah.
Yeah, Outpost.
Yeah. I mean,
that's a similar, like a modern day version of...
100%.
Yeah.
Of that.
I mean, August 23rd.
And that, what a horrible, you know, place to put a base.
And who would put them in the valley like that?
Without anything above.
Yes, like no support. At least
you had a mountain, but you put someone up on it.
Yeah.
They didn't even put Outpost. They had no OPs, you know, very little anything up there. And it's...
That's right, Outpost.
Two Medal of Honors. Two Medal of Honors in that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they did a good job. That whole film, they did a great job on that film. I mean, I'll give it to them on that because they included some of the guys for that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and hopefully, we get to see some movies on this stuff.
We can't depend on Hollywood, but we can depend on Jocko.
Yes.
He's getting our stories out, and... And by the time this is aired by Jocko, there will be a SOG Prairie Fire video game that will go on market May 6th, which just happens to be my daughter's birthday, so I can't forget the date. And it'll be on sale. And try one. Today being the 5th and all, Sergeant.
It is. My bad. Sorry, I'm old.
Anyways, that'll be out there, and we continue to march forward. So anything else that we want to add in our analysis here, Tom the Technician?
No, besides a little wire loose, but, you know, we'll figure that out. I think it was, I think it went well. That was an amazing story. It's great to see that. I can't wait for the next one.
We're pushing.
I'm already, you know, I'm just going to put a bed here pretty soon just so I can keep keep up on all this, but it was phenomenal. It was great to meet Larry. It's great to hear his story and, you know, and see what you guys did.
Yeah, amazing man. And like I said, he and Ricardo Davis, I was always amazed when I learned how old they were, because I just thought they were young, hard chargers like the rest of us. But they were both senior time and grade, you know.
They were old, hard chargers. They don't knock the age.
Indeed. Well, on that, we will close our post-interview analysis. Again, we thank Jocko and his Jocko Productions for giving us the Sawcast. And as always, we always close out thanking all of our service members who are putting their lives online, the first responders, and many other people around the world that are working to help make our country a better place. We'll sign off until next time. We'll see you on Sawcast 6 in the very near future.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.